Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode. And today I am rejoined by my friend, Jane Claridge. Welcome.
Hello.
So today we thought we would do a analysis breakdown, just general discussion of the jury, which is a Channel 4 I suppose it's an experiment, isn't it, to see whether to determine whether our jury system is fit for purpose. And these are real life cases that they're having a rerun of, and just seeing what verdict these additional juries, panel of juries, come to. So we're going to discuss season two. Now, we do know the name of, because although obviously they were, the names were changed for the purpose of this exercise, mainly so it didn't sway the jury's decisions, so they could look up the case. But so we do actually know the name of season two, which is, what do we say it was, Jen?
Emma Jane. I can't find her surname.
Can't find her surname.
Why?
We'll put it in the description. her name on season two was Sophie. And the victim was Ryan.
Yeah.
Now, Sophie was 23, 23-year-old, single mum when she met Ryan. She had a pretty problematic upbringing, didn't she? You know, she didn't have the best start as a young mum. You know, she had problems within her own childhood, didn't she?
Yeah, very much domestic violence by the signs of it, and upbringing.
Yeah. But ultimately, Sophie ended up killing her boyfriend after a night out. But he wasn't innocent either, was he? He was very volatile. There was a history of there was a history. What was interesting to me was the his ex-partner and how she was, she, because even though he wasn't around, she was still very much protecting him until she was questioned further on certain things they had evidence of.
She just couldn't see it, could she? She
yeah.
just couldn't see the way things were moving. And that certainly came out after, you know, when they first started asking her questions. She was, you know, he was certainly on a pedestal, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And then the further they got in, especially when the defense started questioning her on some of the things that were coming out, some of the text messages, the threat to break her nose, pushing her against the wall, all sorts of stuff like that. And then you start seeing it actually coming out, don't you?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Then she had to concede, didn't she? She had to concede on things that they knew that they had evidence of. But she was still very, very much inclined to, and that just demonstrates, doesn't it, how most victims, we want to cling on to the the person that we believe we met at the start of the relationships, that's the person we cling on to, and that's the person we're always seeking to keep finding, refinding. Because if I can just get them help, well, then that person, that old person, that good person will reappear again, and that person actually never existed, really.
Absolutely, absolutely. And like, I think we're, also raised a lot of the time not to kind of recognize certain behaviors are existing or wrong, or we blame ourselves in some sort of way, and or there's a sort of societal sort of bias that you grow up around, and it just all sort of embeds inside, doesn't it? And all sorts of complex reasons why you might not believe that there has been abuse. Yeah, and you could certainly see that really clearly with his ex-girlfriend.
100%. And he very, very evidently didn't like the idea of Emma, which is her real name, and or Sophie, as in the name that they used in the jury, being in contact with her. That he didn't like that idea, because that's why she got threatened to have a nose broken.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because, that's where you start to find out the truth about people, isn't it? When you sort of start talking to the exes or people, that are named in sort of like the past life or whatever, like they're trying to sort of run from and things. So yeah, I definitely don't like that.
100%. The common thing as well was is that she that the, it appears that the esc and it's more likely to be that there was an escalation in his behavior once he started on the steroids and the other substances. It probably will have been there before, but more it was easier to cover up. But when you've got when the steroids in the system, obviously it makes them even more volatile. And I know that because I've dated somebody years ago who took steroids, and that's I can speak firsthand on that. But that's where that's I think that was the last 2 years of that ex's relationship, which means that is the person that Emma was living with. And again, what was interesting was that when she met him, it was very carefully, it appears as though it was Emma's idea for him to move in, but he presented himself as this. If he was a woman, he would have been a damsel in distress.
Yeah, absolutely, because his ex had just literally come out and he was kind of homeless, wasn't he? So, yeah.
So although he didn't directly say, "Can I move in?" he positioned himself so she felt like, well, I suppose obligated in a way to say, "Oh well," and it kind of fitted in with her desire to have this perfect family unit, because that's what she made so secret of it. That's what she desperately craved for her own child.
Yeah, and that's where this whirlwind sort of like beginning came from, isn't it? Sweet, swept off her feet by, we expect he was, real cheeky chappy when he first met her, sort of putting that on just to make her feel sort of like comfortable and safe, and that, he was, amazing and loving and great and stuff. So yeah, and like you said, the being homeless at the time, and yeah, probably felt that obligation to sort of look after him like a mother, kind of like a lot of women are raised to do, caretakers,
And that's typically, as we know, that's typically how, certainly women who have lacked that emotional stability growing up, they become the caregiver because they take on the role, well, if I just look after you and care for you and give you lots and lots of love, then maybe I will be worthy of your time, your love, your commitment, your affection.
Given what they didn't have.
Yeah. So she saw that as an opportunity to start proving herself, to become worthy, because actually it wasn't him. He actually said to her that my friend wants your number. And she didn't like his friend. It was and she, but you can have my number. And he was straight round that day, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And never left. Lying there with his black bags.
So, so straight away, when we're looking at the patterns, because this is what we as risk assessors, we look for patterns. And that's the first thing that we look for is how did the relationship start? And straight away, it wasn't off to a great start. To other people, it seems like a fairy tale, but that's not off to a great start at all.
No, definitely not. It's like a kind of instant kind of entrapment, isn't it?
Yeah,
Entrapment
it
can
is.
usually happen over a
100%.
period of time, but this was kind of, an instant thing, wasn't it? In this
Yeah.
case.
And then there is the point that both of them were quite volatile. Both of them. And this is where we have to really, really get honest. Because it's too easy to side with the person who is mainly at the receiving end. But they were both really volatile, weren't they? Both of them.
Absolutely, absolutely. You could
Yeah.
see clearly that Sophie had a history of sort of violent behavior, and so did Ryan.
Yeah.
Emma and James.
James, yeah. James
Yeah.
is his real name, yeah. And both of them under the influence of substances and alcohol. Yeah. Which goes back to, which is why I always say that irregardless of who's the antagonist, who's the aggressor, the main aggressor. Alcohol and drugs is a huge risk factor, certainly when there's children involved, because it makes if you are inclined to be volatile and reactive, it's going to shine a great big spotlight on that, and it you're like a caged animal that you can't control.
And the thing is, she said that she lets her anger out when she drinks.
Yeah.
But if you think about what may have been happening while she wasn't drinking, all that sort of being compounded up, and then when she does drink, it's just like bam, she just like lets go, doesn't it? If somebody's got like a really calm, safe life in general, when they drink, I mean, generally, you wouldn't see those kind of
No.
explosions and that sort of like volatile behavior, would you?
No.
But when someone's got a history like, Sophie or Emma, it is going to come out like that. And then certainly, if she's now in a relationship where there is abuse happening, she's being called names all the time, and being degraded, and all sorts of things like that. When she does drink, that's it. It's a recipe for disaster, isn't it,
Yeah,
really?
it is. It is. Yeah. It's literally, throwing fuel onto the fire that's already burning.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and this is where, we have victims have a responsibility, particularly when they are the other, if not only to themselves and to the other person and to other people, more so to their own children. If you know you have a tendency to be that reactive under the influence, it is your responsibility to seek the help and not put and avoid putting yourself in that position where you are under the influence and you have a high, particularly when you know that person is constantly pressing your buttons all the time. And they're more likely to do it too as well when they're under the influence. If you are also under the influence, well, that's just a recipe for disaster. It's inviting because it's opening the door to a fatality waiting.
Everybody needs to be accountable for their behaviors. Everybody, like, and we know that, having a traumatic upbringing, traumatic childhood, traumatic time in general, can cause these reactive responses. When you recognize that, even if, you're on the victim side, if you're the one being victimized and you're reacting in certain ways, like violent resistors or reactive responses, it and you know this is happening, it is your responsibility to take accountability for that behavior and do what you can to sort of try and heal from that. And I think that's what separates, a victim from a perpetrator, is that a perpetrator will not take accountability or responsibility most of the time for their behavior. Whereas a victim who's reacting will often take responsibility. You saw that, with Gabby Petito when she was completely blaming herself after she had attacked, hit Brighton. She took complete responsibility. I know in my case, if I did something, I would always hold my hands up and I'd be like, oh my God, I can't believe, I've done that. I'm so sorry. I would take full responsibility, and things like it kind of is what separates us. But it's really, really important to move on, to be able to move on and take the steps to heal and work on those behaviors, because we can't, just because we're traumatized, we cannot walk around
Been a risk to
hurting
other
people,
people.
being a risk to other people, hurting ourselves, hurting our children. It's really, really important for us to be able to do that as well.
Well, we're just going to break for a short interval, and we shall see you after the break.
Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, aunt and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So we've got the name now, which we double checked it. Emma Jane Magston is her actual name. Because we couldn't remember the surname. But before the break, we were saying about this is not victim blaming because, one thing that myself and Jen don't do is victim blame, but we are very real. And we have to look at risk management is as much our responsibility as it is anybody else's. And given that she had a child, a young child, knowing that she was very aware of how volatile she could be. She could have, should have got herself the help. Equally, I don't believe for one minute that, because she at that point she was very close to her grandmother. Surely her grandmother would have known how volatile that she was. That she must have known about her arrests and the circumstances surrounding those arrests. The people who love her should have encouraged her, and they may have done. but she may not have listened potentially. But equally, the system's failed to risk manage. And, this is something that I say repeatedly, whenever I've attended the station with victims that I've supported, I've always said to them, look, we know it's hard to prove, but your job is risk management. And if you know there's a child involved, you're not just risk managing potential escalation involving other adults. You're protecting a vulnerable child as well from the fallout of what may or may not be. And unfortunately, now there is a young child without a mother. Unnecessarily. This did not need to happen.
Absolutely. She was arrested a few times by the looks of it. And, I do. And she was in a past relationship with a domestic abuse perpetrator. There was lots of evidence of that. I have to wonder where anybody stepped in, sort of social services, the police. Did they step in? Where were they? What happened? What did they do? Because from the way it's escalated to where this point now where she's in prison for murder, what where was that risk management?
And that's not necessarily to say that they should have stepped in and taken her child. That's not because that's not something I condone unless it is in extreme circumstances. So in a situation like hers, with the information that we're aware of, because that was what we all week all myself and Jen can go off when we talk about these cases, is what we are what's publicly made aware made available to us. But with what we can publicly see, I think there was potential for to sit her down and say, look, unless we get you the help and the support that you need to break this cycle, we will have to step in. But right here, right now, we're going to help you. We're going to go to this service, go to that service, go to this therapy, go to, go back to your grandmother, if you need somebody to, if you don't want to be on your own and you fear jumping back into another relationship until you are more feeling more stable and settled within yourself. That's the sort of hand holding that authorities need to be giving, as opposed to going in like a bull in a china shop, which can actually cause more harm than good. Now, if you've tried the softer approach and it doesn't work, granted, there's only so far you can go with this nurturing approach before you have to say, okay, now we need to step in and escalate intervention for the safety of the child. But I think there was potential with what we know that a softer approach may have done the trick with her and just said, and made her aware that if you don't sort this out, then we will ha your child will have to be protected from the environments that you're exposing them to.
I think a lot of the time, when I see this sort of thing day in, day out, working on the front line, children on child protection plans because of domestic abusers, and things like that. And usually, most of the time, when a child is brought on to a child protection plan, things do start to turn around for the person who's being victimized. They do seem to find more strength to be able to move away from that. And obviously there's a bit more support, when it comes to sort of like housing, things like that, the practicalities of being able to leave and sort of the protection, because obviously it's dangerous, isn't it, leaving. But there are a few who it just it's absolutely heartbreaking to see. And it just doesn't do anything, and you know, the person who's being victimized just can't seem to pull themselves out of it. They could, you know, sometimes are offered, you know, the various things, and it just doesn't happen. But I would like to know whether this was offered to Sophie in this, you know, because I think, you know, there would be an even sort of like clearer vision of what was going on really, and for a sort of mindset.
Definitely. So this case is a little bit more, it's not, there's no, it's not black and white, this case. And no, well, no case is black and white, but this one is a little bit more complex because, you know, she's not completely innocent. But then we can see what unfolded that night would cause her, would cause that fatality. Now, as okay, granted, she chose to be under the influence of alcohol, which increased that the likelihood of that outcome. So that was her responsibility. And that's why I say it's not black and white, this case. I think the alcohol also has altered her memory a little bit on how things have played out. Because although she may have stabbed him in the kitchen, I think it's been after he's released his hand from around her throat. But she may not be, it may be that she's lied. It may be that she's just not remembering it as a, you know, in a combination of the drink fueled in drinking a system and trauma and disbelief. I think there was an element of disbelief with her that she's maybe not wanting to believe that's what she's ultimately ended up doing.
I mean, it was, I mean, the evidence is there, as far as I'm concerned, that he had his hands around her throat,
Yeah,
and
oh,
she had
definitely.
bruising, didn't she, around her neck, and that's not the sort of place you get bruising accidentally, I
The
think.
CCTV footage on the on the street before they got, you know, on their way home, you know, that is like, you know, you can't, that's undeniable what was happening.
Yeah, you can clearly see that there was violence that night. You know, she was covered in bruises. She had the bruises around her neck. As far as the argument of whether it happened in the kitchen, like I was saying to Kate, I think sometimes when somebody has their hands around your throat, a lot of the time there is a struggle. Sometimes there's not. In my case, when I was strangled, it lasted for a number of seconds, probably, you know, 4 or 5, 6 seconds, something like that. I didn't struggle in that moment, and then he had let him go, and then, but there was, even though it was a few seconds, there was still bruising around my neck, so that is possible too. Maybe he had put his hands around her throat in the kitchen, he had let go, walked off, and then she stabbed him in the hall. Or maybe he did put his hands around her throat in the kitchen, she stabbed him in the kitchen, he had walked out to the hall, pulled the knife out, and that's when the blood came. Because, you know, not always when the knife is actually in, is there always blood everywhere? So, you know, there's different ways, I suppose, of looking at it, but I do believe that she was strangled that night.
Oh yeah, she definitely was strangled. 100% she was strangled. Right, we're just going to break for another interval and we shall close off this particular case with the final bits of the information. See you after the break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So, welcome back. So, there's a lot of grey area around why he was left to bleed to death, essentially. But we've got to really look at, there's a couple of things to unpick here. He was in a severe enough state that the neighbor noticed something wasn't right through the window. The brother came out and helped Emma carry him in.
Although I'll see it say, he even said himself there was blood, didn't he?
And the quote that the neighbor said, "My heart's bleeding," which means that there must have been blood visible. So then my question is, why did the brother help her carry him in and leave him on the living room floor? Why did nobody call an ambulance whilst he was lying on the floor, lying on the road?
It was like all kind of left.
Why didn't the neighbour ring an ambulance? Why didn't the neighbour ring the police?
Yeah. It just seems very strange, doesn't it? That, you know, he was like in the street, blood everywhere. There was blood on the doorstep. You know, clearly visible. And then he was helped in the house, her and his brother in the house. And then he was left on the floor.
Bleeding. And there's blood on the doorframe.
Yeah.
So allegedly, they're claiming that Emma didn't realise that he was bleeding, but there was blood on the doorframe. So there's no way that blood's got on the doorframe when the ambulance have eventually come and carried him out into the ambulance. The blood's got on the doorframe from that. The blood's got on the doorframe from either him staggering out onto the road, as he said, "My heart's bleeding," or when his brother and her have carried him in. That's when the blood's got onto the doorframe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's pretty impossible that if she stabbed him, whether it's in the kitchen or on the doorstep, when he's gone outside in the street, it's impossible that there wouldn't be any blood.
No. So
it was, you know, it was would have been clearly visible. Then Sophie and the brother carry him inside and he's on the floor, right? Sophie calls an ambulance, but she obviously doesn't say that he's been stabbed. But does the brother know? Like, he must have seen that. And I'm sure he said that there was... So why...
The brother just cried. The brother described that he was breathing, he was making a funny noise when he was breathing. Well, that in itself, even if you didn't see any blood, which I do not believe you didn't see any blood, that in itself says to you that you should call an ambulance and get him help immediately.
Yeah, because I believe, like, when I think about the state that Sophie was in when she'd done that, I, like I said to you, don't think she realized how serious that injury was. She knew what she had done. I think she knew what she had done. She knew she had stabbed him. She took the knife in the bin. Okay, she knew she had stabbed him, but I don't think she realized how serious that injury was. As I was saying to you, her father had stabbed her mother in the leg when she was a child. It's likely she kind of understood in that moment of trauma and confusion and drunkenness, that it wasn't a serious injury. She had seen something like that happen before and the person had survived, and it wasn't, I don't think overly serious. So she was probably in that mind set. She was obviously frightened of getting in trouble. Going straight back to being a child, like when you've done something wrong, say if a child breaks something, they try and hide it, they try and hide what they've done. And I know this is a lot more serious than that, but actually it's very similar.
Well, the brain can't differentiate between, it doesn't understand the difference between, it just knows that, oh, I'm in trouble. That's what represents the greatest danger to me. Whether you've broken a toy or whether you've potentially taken somebody's life, you would instantly go into panic mode and want to cover up if you are. And that's not the same for everybody. And this is what we were chatting about before, weren't we? To say that, well, I've experienced that, and I didn't. It didn't. You can't. Nobody can say how anybody would react in a certain situation, because everybody's breaking point is very different. And actually, somebody's breaking point could be over the most minor thing, but it's not the minor thing that's been the straw that's broken the camel's back. It's been a cumulative effect of all the other things that's led up to that incident. Who's to say what anybody's breaking point is? So we can't say, oh, well, I wouldn't react in that way, and that's very extreme, and I've experienced X, Y, and Z. You can't compare. Did she do wrong by? Yes, she did. Should she have covered up? No, she shouldn't have.
Yeah, see, it's simple to say, isn't it? Like, yeah.
But in the moment, can I understand why she would be panicked and think, right, well, he did get into a fight when he was out. He was drinking and taking drugs, and using those elements of fact to cover up her involvement. And I can understand why, what would cause her to do that through panic and disbelief, because she did love him. I don't disbelieve that she loved him. And I think that was purely disbelief as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because what's interesting is that and again, chatted about this on the break, about the friend of Ryan's, or James, is it Jet? What's he called? James, is
So
it?
James in real life, yeah.
James. She made reference to him telling her that she'd held a knife to his chest and left a mark. Not penetrated, just like indentation. She also made reference to him hitting her, her hitting him over the head with a vacuum pipe or something, which aligns with something the neighbor said, that he witnessed her doing that as well. So because we know that's true, there's a potential that there's an element of truth that maybe the two of them being volatile pressed each other's buttons and gaunted each other.
And
It's highly possible that this has happened again, and maybe this time it's gone too far.
And they're likely, you know, because she's picked up knives before in the past to threaten him with, more than likely because of abuse that she was being subjected to. You know, there's more likely that she can pick up a knife again. Because nothing bad has actually happened before when she's picked up a knife before. That it kind of went a bit far, you know, with, with strangulation and things like that. It went a bit further.
And that, obviously, that's not something that there is evidence of. That's just us looking at something that we know that was brought up, and based off the evidence that's there, there's a possibility that that's true. So if that is true, that's a possible scenario that could have taken place that night that would explain her disbelief of, well, how did I go from this to this? Because that's what happens when the predatory response is triggered. And all it would have taken was a piercing glare from him to trigger that loss of control. That moment. And, you know, that's where if she has gone and gaunted him as she has done maybe previously, and it's gone too far because she's lost control, that's when the wares kicked in. It's like, how has this happened? It's complete disbelief that, well, how has this happened?
Well,
it's a very complex case, isn't it?
Absolutely. I just think, you know, going back to what we were saying before about him being left on that floor to die, essentially. Just where was everybody else?
Yeah, exactly. It's all very well and good to say to her, well, why did you? Well, also, why did the brother and why did the neighbour?
Yeah.
Or neighbours?
When it was clear, like, it was so obvious that, you know, he'd been seriously injured.
Yeah.
You know, I can't believe that, you know, they wouldn't have said it. And by what they were saying as well, they all recognised it. So, yeah, that's my...
Exactly. So it's too easy to pin it all on her, but actually there's other people that actually should be questioned. Well, why did you leave him to die, essentially? All right, she did, but also you and you did.
But, you know, she's, I suppose, got that, I don't want to even really call it an excuse, but trauma response.
Excuse.
Mind is completely somewhere else, you know.
Well, she's in a complete state of panic and disbelief and not want... She was genuinely in a place where that... If I don't acknowledge it, it's not real. It's like a child who doesn't want to hear what mum and dad are saying. And la, 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 la. Covering your ears up. No, you're not. No, I can't hear. It's not true.
It's crazy where our mind can take us.
When we're in a
trauma response, isn't it?
And this is, and, you know, we're going to do another episode to follow on with this because it's such a huge topic. I didn't think we'd get through it all in one episode. but this is why, you know, it isn't, you've got to look at all the different moving parts of a case, particularly with cases like this, because it's not black and white. There's so many things that can influence certain responses, and we can't just simply say, well, I wouldn't behave like that, and that's not how I would have responded, because who's to say how anybody would respond if they're faced in that situation?
Absolutely.
You know, I know I wouldn't be able to say how I would like to think I would respond in a certain way, but I can't say for certain I would.
No. And I think actually, and, you know, obviously I really don't want to offend anyone by saying this, but I do find, and I found this with a couple of members of the jury who were, you know, themselves victims of domestic abuse experienced it. I actually find that some people who've been victimized by domestic abusers can actually be the most judgmental towards other people in domestic abuse.
Yeah.
Because of the way that they've responded, and they feel like everybody should respond the same.
Well, our views on the jury system is another whole separate episode entirely.
Yeah.
That is something we are going to discuss as well, once we've broken down these two series of cases. But we're going to do another episode to follow on with this case, just to make it more comprehensive of an explanation. So thank you, Jan, for joining me. It's been lovely.
Thanks for having me.
And we shall see you on the next episode.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There, you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specialising in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.